A review of the season's new romance novels published in the New York Times started a literary controversy. The author either doesn't like romance novels or maybe is overcompensating for liking them because his tone is totally mocking. Lots of salacious rhetorical questions of the will they, won't they variety and a truly bizarre number of exclamation points for an article in the Times. Well, the article got a response as passionate as romance novels themselves. One of the comments on the article is from a big name in the romance genre, Jennifer Cruz. She writes, "Good to know the patriarchy is alive and doddering on the pages of the New York Times book review. You don't need to find a reviewer who appreciates the genre to review it, but you should try to find somebody who's not chuckling to himself as he recycles ideas that were stale in the 1970s. Try again with an intelligent reviewer who will resist the urge to mansplain something he does not comprehend." I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show on KCUR's Central Standard is a Bibliophiles episode all about love and literature, starting with this cautionary tale about what you can expect if you make condescending generalizations about romance novels in 2018. Katie Stover is going to kick us off. She's with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Katie.
Morning, Gina.
So dive in a little deeper and tell the story of what happened with this article.
Romance readers and publishers of romance were thrilled that the New York Times Book Review devoted the front cover and three pages of text to romance, but they were less than thrilled with the tone that Robert Gottlieb took. So it's a yay, but moment for the genre. And it didn't take long before readers and romance authors and publishers of romance and critics of romance reviewers started going through the article and picking out all of the condescending, dismissive, blatantly wrong statements that Gottlieb made. He evidently does not know what a Regency romance is and didn't bother to look up the definition for a Regency romance.
What is it?
A Regency romance is a subgenre of historical romance. Romances are historical or contemporary. In Gottlieb's article, he says there are two types of romances, Regency and contemporary. And Regency is a subgenre of historical romance. And Regency can cover anywhere from a 10 to 40 year period in Regency England. It is focused on Regency England, the ton, the upper 10% of the population. They are novels of manners. They're very witty. There's little sex. It's about, not to say that there isn't any. You can have a steamy Regency romance, but a Regency romance is about, usually about class. It's about the main characters coming together and overcoming perceptions, misconceptions they have about each other. But most of the story, what readers like about Regency romance, is the historical setting, and they like the witty banter. They love the dialogue. You can think of it as it's got some ties to Jane Austen, but as Gottlieb points out, more ties to Georgette Heyer. She's the one that made it popular.
So when you mention Jane Austen, that brings up this question of what defines a romance novel? Does it have to meet certain criteria? Because there is romance in literature.
There is. Mark and Jeff and I were talking about that. There are romantic elements in literature all over the place. And if you want to, we can trace every genre of literature back to the Bible. But there are two elements of a romance that must be present for a romance novel to be considered a romance novel. And one is a central love story. That is where the focus of the story is. And the second is an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending. The standard HEA, happily ever after. The couple commit to each other. They come together. They overcome their conflicts and they commit to being with each other.
Okay, we're going to get back to that when we have the whole panel of bibliophiles in on this. Just sticking with the New York Times article a little bit more, can you talk to me about agitated response had to do with gender, but also a couple of other issues, the assumption of a heterosexual couple, for example, or even an implication of racism in some of what he was saying. Can you talk to me about where the genre of romance novels is now?
Oh, romance is one of the fastest growing genres all the time. It's always gathering new readers. It's always gathering, always exploring new directions. And I canvassed some of my romance reading friends and experts, and romance is actually opening up. It's going to become more diverse. We're already seeing more culturally diverse historical romances. We're seeing more culturally diverse contemporary romances. We're going to be seeing, so in addition to diverse historicals, a good friend of mine, Robin, believes that we're going to be seeing actually a little less graphic sex in romance. And I thought about that, and I think that that's probably the expected fallout from too much sex of the 50 Shades variety. I think we're going to see, we're seeing more sports in romance. There's always been military romance, so we'll be seeing more of that. I brought one of those with me today. And one of my romance reading friends said, we'll be seeing more contemporary royalty. As the British royals keep marrying commoners, that becomes a wonderful plot point for romance authors to explore. And we'll probably be seeing more of that.
Whoa,
more
so
fun fantasy.
Okay, this brings up, you sent along to me some reader statistics. And as a librarian, you know, you have this wonderful opportunity to not just know who reads what's, you know, we can all get those statistics, but also to talk to people about what they're reading and kind of maybe understand why. So why do people read romance novels in your estimation? I know no one person can answer that question.
Well, I think that a great many romance fans like the hope that romance brings. They like
the obligatory happily ever after.
Yes. So when people want to dismiss romance as being formulaic, well, yes, romance readers know exactly what they're getting into when they pick up a romance. They know they're going to get a happy ending. It's about how the characters get through their conflicts. So readers of romance like to read how the two people, how the two leads who are obviously made for each other, combat their conflicts. How do they work through their problems? Which is something that we do every day in our own relationships, friends, coworkers, spouses, significant others. So readers like to see how are people working through their relationship challenges. Readers want a happy ending. They expect that. And so romance authors are not shortchanging their reader intellectually when they deliver a happily ever after ending.
And there also isn't that, okay, say you're going to pick out your next book that you're going to read and you're feeling a little like overwhelmed with real life. There isn't the danger if you know that the ending is going to be happy, that you're going to come away from this feeling more overwhelmed.
Right. People read for escapism all the time. They read romance for escape. They read urban fantasy. I read crime fiction for escape. Over the holiday, I read Michael Connelly and Robert Crace for escape. So people know that they're going to get a warm, fuzzy, nice sigh of an ending at the conclusion of a romance novel.
So in this breakdown of who's reading what and how different genres are selling, right now, there are the 10 most popular romance tropes are: number 1, friends to lovers; number 2, soulmate / fate; number 3, second chance at love; 4, secret romance; 5, first love; 6, strong hero heroine; 7, reunited lovers, which seems a little like second chance at love, but I will overlook that. Love triangle is number 8. Number 9 is the one that really fascinates me. Sexy billionaire or millionaire.
Oh, those have been around forever.
So is this like kind of along the lines of why this new storyline is popping up about romance with royalty?
You know,
commoners and royalty?
It's not a new storyline. Jeff and I were talking about Janet Daly earlier, and I remember Janet Daly writing a an impoverished girl meets billionaire and writing a prince and commoner tale. Those storylines have been around for a long, long time. We're probably going to see a resurgence in those because of Harry and Meghan and Kate and William. And they're interesting. They're fun. It's in our news right now. And romance authors all pay attention to what's in the news and what are people talking about? What are they tweeting about? What are they Facebooking about? What are they sharing? And then they look at these different snippets from the news and think, well, how do I twist that and turn it into a romance?
So do you think, we're going to bring our other bibliophiles in on this too, but do you think that there is something misogynistic about what the author of this New York Times Book Review article did, the tone he took? That seemed to be, by and large, one of the big complaints.
I can't speak for Robert Gottlieb and know whether or not he's a misogynist or not, but I do find the tone of this article dismissive. He is dismissive of a genre of a body of literature that's done a great deal for the business of publishing, which he is in. I would expect a little bit more from the editor of Toni Morrison and Nora Ephron, but he does not seem to care much for this genre. I question why the New York Times would allow someone who doesn't like the genre to write about the genre. When Gottlieb writes in this manner about this genre, which statistics show is overwhelmingly read by women, and the characters feature women, and it focuses on concerns that all readers should have, it's dismissive of a gender. And that caused a great deal of consternation.
Well, let's get the whole panel in on this. I want to talk to Jeffrey and Gowdy and Mark Luce. They've been listening to this discussion so far. And as always, Jeff is a freelance writer and Mark joins us from Barstow School. Mark, what are your thoughts as you listen to Katie describe who's reading romance, why, what the definition of the genre is, and knowing as you do exactly what happened with this whole debacle?
I have to be honest, I haven't really read that many romance novels. I think I've peeked at a couple here and there. It's not marketed to me, right? I mean, it's simply not marketed to me. When this topic came up and when I read the article by Gottlieb, I was rather disgusted by what he had to say. And it's like low-hanging fruit.
As a non-reader of this genre, what was it that disgusted you?
His tone. I mean, it's just like so, like, it's one thing to be dismissive. It's one thing to have opinions, right? But the way in which he talked about this, in particular, the one that really rankled me was the race. It really bothered me.
Can you explain that?
He said that in this particular novel that the characters were African American, but you would never know that. And I...
Except for the cover.
Except for the cover. And yeah. And I read that as, oh, there's a particular way you expect African Americans to be. And I found that...
And to love each other.
I found it just bad, you know.
So
it reminded me of this book by Janice Radaway that I read in graduate school called Reading the Romance. And in it, she basically does a sociological study of a group of suburban women who read romance novels and explores from a variety of different theoretical perspectives exactly why they read it. And what she comes up with is kind of a couple different things. It's like, on one hand, right, you can say that people read romance to as a sort of quiet rebellion and to reclaim the identity that they don't have in their daily life, like as a female. And then on the other hand, so if you're coming from a feminist point of view, that perhaps these things actually dull or slow down the types of sort of progressive changes that could come. It's a fascinating book. It was published in 1984. It was reprinted in 1991. And really the first sort of serious academic look at romance novels and who and why people are reading them.
And that it's satisfying sort of valid impulses, whether you like the literature itself or not, that they're impulses and curiosities shared by a large number of people.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, as when in my 20s, I would sort of dismiss that stuff out of hand, sort of in a literary sense. But I think as I get older, it's like, and especially after reading that book when I was in my mid-20s, people read for a variety of reasons, and far be it from me to tell them what they should or should not be reading. And so, and it basically, the sales of romance novels keeps literary novels in print. Like, let's be honest.
Jeff?
The thing that really offended me that Gottlieb wrote was, why shouldn't women dream? After all, guys have their James Bonds as role models. I mean, that is just, what is that about? It is dripping with condescension. And the fact that he's 86-year-old white guy, I mean, it's offensive.
So tell me what, like, for you, regardless of genre, we've already identified that love stories make up a lot of literature just across the board. What is your sense of what makes a love story literary in the more traditional sense as opposed to the genre sense?
Well, I have to say that I've only read one genre romance in preparation for this show, but I would say that many, many books, many novels have romance or a love story at their core, but there's layer upon layer upon layer. And my sense of genre romance, and I could be contradicted here by people who read more widely in the genre, is that the conquest, the surrender, the mating is more at the core of the genre romance.
So it's not
boiled down.
Like, okay, if I were to say to you, Homer's Odyssey could arguably be a love story. It's the love story of a warrior who goes off, wife who's left at home, loving the wife, who doesn't know if he's going to make it back, but yet is so committed to the belief that he will return despite everyone agreeing, no, he's been gone too long, he's not coming back, that she's turning down suitor after suitor. They're doing crazy things to get her attention. And in the end, spoiler alert, if anyone's dying in suspense over how Homer's Odyssey ends,
he
comes
happily.
Back and they get back together. So is Homer's Odyssey a romance?
He took a bit of a break, though, halfway home.
He
spent a lot of time
on that island with those
with
sirens.
With the fancy women.
Yeah.
So the Odyssey has elements of a romance, but no, it's not a romance because the focus of that story is on Odysseus's adventures. We don't really know a whole lot about what Penelope's doing at home. We get a couple of scenes. She's chewing off these suitors that aren't after Penelope because she's a beautiful, intelligent, loving woman. They want her estate. So she's holding out hope that her husband will come home. Odysseus is out having all these different adventures. And then he comes home, and then it does turn into a little bit of a romance. She kind of puts them through some paces, and they have to work through their conflicts. So towards the very end, you could make an argument there are some elements of the romance there. But on the whole, the
English
Odyssey
teacher in the
not.
Room is laughing at me. But
he kills all the suitors, he and his son kill 100 guys.
That's to satisfy
so
the
romantic,
James Bond.
Right?
Yeah.
The reason I bring this up, because we're going to be moving on to talking about the great love stories in literature, and the Odyssey, that romance is kind of controversial in feminist circles because the ideal of this sort of waiting woman seems to some people, I guess, very anti-feminist. And I understand that. But I also think that it is so clever what she does, that she weaves and then unweaves this tapestry. She weaves it like every day and then unweaves it every night. And so she's told them that she'll move on when she's done with this tapestry. And I don't know. I kind of think that she's sticking to her guns no matter what anyone else says to her. And B, she's being very clever. And I don't know that I think of this as like an example or not. I mean, forgetting about that, it's memorable to me. When I think memorable literary romances, I do think of Penelope and Odysseus.
Well, it's a part of the story that you remember. It's part of Penelope taking control of her life. And I have rarely read a romance where it is not about a woman taking control of her life and deciding. It's about the woman getting to choose. All the bloodletting at the end, notwithstanding, Penelope does put Odysseus through a few more paces to see, does he still love her? Is he who he says he is? Do they have a future together?
So regardless of genre, you guys, what does make romantic love really work, not in life, but on the page? What makes it, whether it's a successful romance or not, what makes it compelling?
That's kind of a broad question, but I would say opposites attract, an attraction, somebody coming at something and not settling, but settling on their own terms.
Yeah, I always think of it as the people find each other somehow, and then they're thwarted for any number of reasons. It could be social reasons, it could be emotional reasons, it could be money reasons, right? Then they somehow overcome this and find each other again, only then maybe to be thwarted yet again. And so sometimes, to me, the best romances in literature have happy endings. Sometimes they have crushingly sad endings. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's sort of that difference. It's like, I mean, are literary romances somewhat formulaic? Yeah, actually they are. I mean, not quite the same way that genre is. But it's like, to me, the difference is those won't have happy endings. I mean, those will have happy endings, and literature might not.
Right. Very true, very true. Right.
I brought Possession by A.S. Byatt that does not have the requisite happily ever after for either of the couples in this book. And everyone remembers Bridges of Madison County, Robert James Waller.
Oh, yeah.
That is not a romance.
Why not?
Because the couple who are in love with each other, it is a book about it with a central love story, but they are not together at the end of the book.
Well, okay, we're going to be getting all of the bibliophiles' recommendations for literary love stories and romance novels when KCUR's Central Standard returns. Share yours too. Call 816-235-2888 or tweet your recommendations. We are at KCUR CST. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with the Bibliophiles, English teacher Mark Luce of the Barstow School, Katie Stover from the Kansas City Public Library, and freelance writer Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Hi again, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
So it's cold outside, and we are staying warm with great love stories and literature. Call 816-235-2888 with your recommendations. They can be recently published books or classics of all time. And Mark Luce, I want to start with All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy. Cormac McCarthy isn't the guy you expect on this list.
No, but this is a romance in a few different ways. There is a romance between John Grady Cole and Alejandra, right? And it's a romance that can't be, right?
Explain it for those who have not read this book.
He's a gringo and she's from Mexico, and her father will not let that will not happen, period. Now, that said, they do have this sort of steamy romance with moonlight rides on horses, and this, you know, it's a month or two long romance. So there's that element of it. And of course it's not going to work out. But there's also an element of it where there's a romance of sort of the land and of the attitude or occupation of the cowboy. John Grady's grandfather has died and his family's getting rid of the ranch. So what he thought his life was going to be, which was to basically be a horseman, is now gone. And so he has to go south, basically to more frontier, to find this type of life. When he returns, what he finds is technology has sort of gotten in the way, and automobiles and telephone lines and radio, and that technology is simply squeezing his way of life out. And so, much like Huckleberry Finn, he literally rides off into the sunset going west. And so
I like the idea that a romance is not necessarily, or a great love story is not necessarily a person and another person in the romantic love sense, but that you can have that same sense of longing for something out of the past or for the land or...
Well, I mean, I think in some ways what he is hoping for, this certain kind of life, is really no different than the monster in Frankenstein is looking for. The monster in Frankenstein, it's like, yeah, he kind of wants a girlfriend at one point, but what he really wants is his dad. Do you know what I mean? Like, his dad just splits. You know, Victor makes the monster and then runs away, and the monster just wanders around like, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to live? How do I talk? How do I learn things? How do I have relationships? And the dad's nowhere to be found.
Frankenstein is a love story.
Depending on how you look at it. I mean, to me, it's like the most romanticism, like written large, because it has all this nature and awe and all those kind of things that the Romantics were into. But I don't know that Frankenstein is a love story between Victor and Elizabeth at all. I think if it's a love story between anyone, it's Victor and Henry. Like, I think they're closer than... I mean, the monster tells Victor that, hey, on your wedding night, I'm going to kill your wife. And so on the wedding night, Victor's like, hey, I'm going to go downstairs and check on stuff. And then shockingly, his wife/cousin is dead. And then he just kind of wanders the earth with Frankenstein.
And that does seem like not the happy ending of a romance novel.
No, although I will say the monster kind of setting himself on fire, like, certainly seems like a cool sort of romantic thing. Like, building a pyre and crawling on top of it and setting himself aflame is kind of cool.
Thank you for following me on this tangent when you were really recommending All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy, but also on the side, maybe Frankenstein.
Yes.
And so, Jeffrey N. Gowdy, talk to me about, there's this fairly contemporary book on your list, Landline by Rainbow Rowell. I've read that one too, and I think it's a great book.
Excellent.
It's technically a young adult book, but I didn't even know that when I read it.
Well, supposedly this is one of her crossover books. Then when I bought it, it was because Janet Maslin of the New York Times recommended it and said it was an adult novel. But it sure was fun. It was like candy. And I remember when I read it in 2014, I talked to Katie about it. Katie said this is the weakest of her books. But having nothing else to compare it to, I thought it was really, really good. And this isn't a romance in a traditional way. But
Tell the story.
Okay, so it's a rekindling of a dormant romance. So Georgie McCool, who has a name that's as interesting as Rainbow Rowell, is a TV writer, and she's married to Neil, and he's the stay-at-home dad of two daughters. And even though she's writing for a sitcom she considers it kind of hack work, she's very consumed by the work. And her bosses come and tell her that she and the co-writers have been pitching a pilot for a long time, and they can actually work up what they've been asking for years. But they have to produce 4 episodes in 10 days, and they have to do it over the Christmas holiday. And she and her husband have planned to return to Omaha to visit Neil's mother. And she says, I'm sorry, I can't go. So Neil goes off in a quiet huff, and there's sort of a question lingering in the air. Has he left her? And she finds that she misses her family so much, she can't work at all. So she goes to stay with her mother in an L.A. suburb. And she's calling Neil all the time on his cell phone. He doesn't answer. But in her room, in her old childhood bedroom, is a yellow rotary telephone. And when she calls Neil on this telephone, he answers. But it's not the current Neil. It's the Neil she fell in love with in college. The, you know, satirical guy that was very charming. And so she rediscovers the sort of dormant romance, or the romance that's kind of gone by the wayside, in talking to Neil on this rotary phone. And as in traditional romances, there are, you know, competitors. Neil has an old girlfriend who's living in Omaha who's kind of lurking around him.
Well, and rather than going into all of the sort of subplots, what is it about this story that just works for you? Regardless of forgetting the romance genre, what is it about this relationship that makes it feel so real, even though it's so far-fetched that your current self can go back and have conversations on the phone with your partner, but that person not knowing everything that's happened in the last couple of decades.
Yeah. I mean, there is that science fiction element, but I mean, it's basically just a metaphor about rediscovering what drew you to the person in the first place. And that maybe gets lost in the hubbub of work and dishes and somebody, you know, blowing their nose in the morning or whatever. And I thought it was very touching. I thought it was very propulsive, very energetic, very fun to read, and almost felt like a guilty pleasure. You know,
that's Landline.
Too much fun to read.
By Rainbow Rowell. Let's talk to Greg, who's calling us from Overland Park at 816-235-2888. Hi, Greg.
Hello there.
What do you want to recommend?
Well, I just wanted to say that obviously I'm a dude, and this is the first year I decided to read a romance novel. I'm a librarian, and I wanted to get a wider range of experience, and romances always have the most baggage, I guess, attached to them. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to go pick up a Regency romance and just straight ahead romance and find out what I thought about it. And I picked up Temptations of a Wallflower by an author named Eva Leigh, L-E-I-G-H. And it's kind of a meta story about a society lady who writes erotic novels under a pen name. And this is obviously very scandalous. And the hero is a guy who's tasked to find this mysterious author, and sparks fly. It's smart, it's well written, and it's very humorous, and it's also kind of sly. And even though I knew the two characters would fall in love just within the first 10 pages, I didn't mind. And it's just, that's one of the main criticisms you hear about romance is that, well, these two people are obviously going to fall in love and have a happily ever after. But it's like saying, you know, Harry Potter is going to overcome and defeat Voldemort within the first 20 pages of a Harry Potter novel. Obviously, it's the point. And the joy and the experiences and the journey of learning about these characters and rooting for them and kind of going through their obstacles and struggles. And I'm really glad that I read it. And I really recommend everyone, if you've never read a romance novel, try to pick one up, see what it's about, see why people out there love it, because a lot of people out there do.
Greg, do you think that you're going to read more romance novels now?
This is a year, first of the year, we want to kind of expand our horizons and maybe dedicate ourselves. And yes, I'm going to read, my next read is going to be a contemporary romance. To see kind of getting away from the classic, you know, there's all these different types of subgenres out there, and I'd like to explore and find out a little bit more about it.
Well, thanks, so. Greg.
Absolutely.
Okay, Katie Stover, what do you want to recommend to us now?
Well, I will recommend an old romance that I absolutely adore, and it's from Nora Roberts, the contemporary queen of romance. And this one, I brought my favorite of all of Nora Roberts' books, and it's Honest Illusions. I'm sure people will be able to find it in the library. And this is one of her standalones, one of her glitz and glamour standalones. And what I liked about this series of standalones she was doing in the late 90s is that she would take a frame, like an antique shop or a magician's family, and that's what this one is, set in the world of magic, and do like a saga, a present, past, present. Where did our couple, where did they meet? What's their situation right now? They hate each other. Let's go back in the past and see how their relationship developed and how they came apart. And then we're back in the present. They're back together. They have this conflict. They don't want to be together, but we know that they will come together. So in Honest Illusions, it's the Nouvelle family of magicians. And there's Luke, this street kid who picks pockets, and Roxanne, this budding young musician. And Luke is raised by the family. He and Roxanne forge a strong bond. And then something comes between them and sends Luke off for several years to explore another part of his life. Roxanne continues the family business of performing magic. Then they come together because essentially this is a family of jewel thieves. So in addition,
it is.
Mark, borrow this. This is one of my favorite romances. And I have to tell you, I'm one of those romance readers in a big, thick paperback romance like this. I'm more prone to skipping the sex because I'm really interested in the dialogue and the story. Jeff is giving me that look. You would do that? Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in the relationship, the development of the relationship. I don't need to see what's going on in the bedroom. Like, yeah, that's nice. Get back to the dialogue. Get back to the plot development. Get back to creating your relationship and coming together and facing your challenges. So, Honest Illusions by Nora Roberts, one of my absolute favorites.
And speaking of magic and romance coming together, I polled KCUR staffers about their recommendations, and there's one that's very consistent with this combination of themes. Mike Russo tells us about The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern.
That's fun. It's very magical. Yeah.
So it seems like...
that does have a very strong romance at the core. Absolutely.
Tell us about it. I have what Mike says, but I have not read it myself.
I mean, I can't remember it that well, but there is magician and magical elements to it, and definitely people drawn together against all the odds, and good recommendation.
Yeah, Mike says it's about dueling wizards who are also star-crossed lovers. I don't mean to laugh. It's hard to say that sentence, though, without that. Dueling wizards, who are also star-crossed lovers. The backdrop is a mysterious magical circus, and he says that it is romance masquerading in magic.
Love it. Perfect.
He's right. It is. And it's the writing is lush and elegant and will completely captivate the reader. It takes you to a whole new world.
We also have a tweet from Kathleen Connigan-Gross, who is also a KCUR staffer. She says, looking forward to the show Confession Time. I used to be a total anti-romance snob. And then one day, back when I worked at a Borders Books, a customer came in looking for a particular title. We found the book she wanted and it had a baseball player on the cover. And I literally said to her, wait, there are romance books with baseball players? She then proceeded to recommend a few baseball-themed romances to me.
Oh, I love that.
I need to chat with her about NASCAR romances.
Okay, well, we're going to be
There's a market there.
It exists. It's a thing.
We'll be right back to this conversation of great loves in literature on KCUR Central Standard. You can call 816-235-2888 with the love story on the page that really worked for you. I'm Gina Kaufman. Be right back. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and on a ridiculously cold day, we are going to help you find a good book to curl up with that's got a good love story in it. And these can range from romance novels to not romance novels. There's love in literature just across the board. So we're going to get back to our bibliophiles, Katie Stover, Mark Luce, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. You guys, what about Jane Austen? She comes up on a couple of your lists in different ways. Mark is recommending a book by Jane Austen, and then Jeff has one that's kind of an adaptation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I think Jane Austen is all about courtship and economics, hardcore economics, right? As well as romance.
Yeah. I mean, to me, Persuasion is a little bit different because I think in that one, she's the... She can't have the fellow because he's poor, right? And her father
economics.
and well, yeah, in that way, yes. And then it changes all of a sudden. But the thing that I like about that particular novel so much,
Persuasion,
yeah, is that that Anne Elliot, who's the main character, she makes a decision when she's young that she comes to regret, and basically kind of gets to play out and sort of sticks by her guns and makes a decision for herself later that is a really good decision and shows that her initial instincts were actually quite fine and that her father and his sort of class trappings were thoroughly and completely mistaken.
Economics. Well, yeah, I brought in Cookbook Collector by Allegra Goodman, which is sort of a reprise of Sense and Sensibility, which is Jane Austen's first book. And two sisters here of differing personalities and dispositions and on the cusp of choosing the correct guy, you know, right guy, wrong guy. And this book is highly romantic. And there is a seduction scene involving the eating of a peach. And I swear you'll never look at a peach the same way. It's lovely. And there's just so much. This book is stuffed almost too much with too much. But there is a real heavy romance at the core between a contrarian bookstore owner who's 16 years the senior of a young dreamy girl named Jess. She's the dreamy sister, 23-year-old. Then there's the practical sister. And she helps him score a collection of vintage cookbooks, and then she begins to catalog them in his lovely arts and crafts home. He is a snob about food and wine, and he wants to feed her the most delectable dishes, and I'm all for it. It is lovely, and I have actually mentioned this book on air before, and people will call in and say it's one of their absolute favorites. It's a lovely book.
It's funny. I mean, that takes literary romance to a different level, that part of the romance itself is cataloging books.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's actually a subplot involving a rabbi and all sorts of dot-com business, and it's a 9/11 book. I mean, it's a lot.
Huh. Okay. Well, that's The Cookbook Collector by Allegra Goodman, and Mark was recommending Persuasion by Jane Austen. Katie, you have a pretty long list, and I'm looking at your pile of books, and it looks meaningfully separated into subpiles. So I'm going to let you tell me what you're going to talk about next.
Right. Well, I brought three older examples of what are called category romances, and they are from the Harlequin line and Silhouette, for those romance readers out there who've been doing this for a while and remember Silhouette. And one of them is, two of these books are by Jennifer Crusie, who's one of the romance authors credited with bringing back the romantic comedy elements in the romance novel. And I brought Anyone But You, because that's part of Harlequin's Love and Laughter line. It doesn't exist any longer, but if you can find those books, they are fun. And then I also brought Stolen Moments series, and this one is Sizzle by Jennifer Crusie. This is rather hard to find.
The cover says it's too hot to handle. Be careful.
Yes. This is one of the first really steamy, sexy romances. It's really tiny. It's not even 50 pages. But there's a lot of comedy. It's like it would make a great movie. And this is one of those books that came out that were designed just for like lots of steamy sex between the protagonists. And they work in an advertising firm, and she is extremely creative but spends money like crap mad, and he's an accountant, wants to control her budget, and whoops, sparks fly in the boardroom. They've both got fun secretaries. It's like a bit, a romance, a hot, sexy, romantic bit in literature. And then I also brought us an Intimate Moments from Silhouette, and I don't believe this line, I know this line doesn't exist any longer, but Intimate Moments focused on issues in romance. And this one's by Kathleen Corbell. It's called A Soldier's Heart. Kathleen Corbell is a pseudonym for a St. Louis romance author named Eileen Dreyer. And this is one of my absolute favorites. I've kept this one for years. But this book, A Soldier's Heart, is about two Vietnam War veterans. One was a Marine sergeant and the nurse who saved him in Vietnam. And 20 years later, he's gone back to look for the nurse that saved him. He needs to connect with her. And when he finds her, he realizes that she's confused. She's having problems. She's suffering from PTSD. And he has suffered from that as well. And so he's got a grasp on it. And now he's going to try and help this nurse, Claire, get over her PTSD. And it's really very touching. It's very honest, and it's very true to the experiences of PTSD among Vietnam War veterans. And this one is a bit of a tearjerker. Yes, it ends happily. The Marine sergeant falls in love with the nurse, and the two of them have this pretty large challenge to get through. They both suffer from PTSD. He knows how to handle his. She does not understand that that is what she has been suffering from.
Wow, that's really intense.
Yes.
You said something a minute ago about the romance novel coming back to like the romantic comedy.
Oh, I hope it does.
What does that mean?
There's always been a lot of comedy in romance. And this line, Harlequin's Love and Laughter, Jennifer Crusie just made it just outright funny. Just taking the elements of a romantic comedy movie and dumping them so well into a book. And she is still one of romance's funniest writers, right up there with Susan Elizabeth Phillips, and I'm drawing a blank on several others. But she could always make me laugh. Of Jennifer Kearse's
novels. Are they dialogue-driven?
Yes, they're dialogue. They've got that screwball
like the
comedy.
That's what I was thinking. Like,
I love screwball
Page or
comedy.
Thin Man.
Yes, yeah. And so if you like those sorts of movies, then you would like these romantic mm-hmm. comedies. Now you're seeing, I'm actually seeing more of that romantic comedy banter pop up in historical romances. And the one I'm thinking back on is When a Scot Ties the Knot by Tessa Dare, I believe. It's funny. And the woman is a biologist. She wants to study lobsters. And he owns, he has a troop of Scottish.
Let me guess, he has lobster traps?
No.
Oh.
He's a Scottish warrior.
Who knows how to tie a knot?
No, the knot is the wedding knot.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I bet he knows how to tie knots, too. If he's a warrior, he's got to be a knot guy.
Let's talk to Carrie. Carrie appears to be calling us from Kentucky. Hi, Carrie.
Yeah. Hi.
Are you in Kentucky?
I am in Kentucky. I'm listening to you streaming.
Well, thanks. What do you want to share?
I think the best book that I read this year, the best romance, was called Hate to Want You by an author named Alicia Rye. That's Alisharai. And it's a modern take on Romeo and Juliet, except nobody has to die in the end. So that's
dying
that's an upper for me.
Yeah.
No dying in the end. They actually get together. It is a sexy book. And I would recommend to Jeffrey Ann that you go ahead and read the sex in this book.
No, that was Katie.
That's
you
me. I'm tendency to skip it.
That was Katie.
But I won't.
I don't think you should. Yeah, don't skip it because she does a really good job of making that plot relevant. Part of how these two solve their problems and communicating with each other happens in the bedroom. So if you skip those chunks, you miss part of the story.
I won't.
Plus, it's fun. It's fun. It's a really great book.
Well, thank you, Carrie. And I hope you'll keep listening to us from Kentucky.
Yeah, now that I have found you, I won't let you go.
Okay.
We that won't sounds let like you go. The last like line of a
sounds
romance
like the
novel.
Title of a romance, yes.
This book, Hate to Want Thanks, You, was recommended guys. To me by someone else.
Well, so, okay. She and this brings up... This just reminded me of a scene in a Murakami book where I think as far as like the steamier scenes in any kind of literature being plot relevant, I mean, if they're not, they generally don't work in the book. They feel like breaks from the book. And there's a Murakami book, I think it was the Windupburg Chronicles, where one of the characters, that is how they transmit information. It's a part of the sci-fi aspect of the plot. I don't know. Talk to me about romance and science fiction. Love and science fiction. You were kind of talking about it before, Mark, with Frankenstein.
Well, you know, I would actually think of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, where Rick Deckard. So that's the Philip K. Dick book that ends up becoming Blade Runner. But it's different. The movie's different and a whole different thing. But in the book... The Deckard, who his job is to hunt down these robots or androids, falls in love with one because they're so lifelike and sort of raises all these sort of questions about like whether the robot has feelings or and so I think of that. I mean, I don't think it's a particular like it's a cool concept. It's not a particularly well written book, kind of by any stretch. What?
Great movie.
Is a great movie, but it's different. They're different beasts. I'm trying to think of other sci-fi romance.
Well, getting off that topic as we get ready to wrap this up, I mean, in my recommendations from KCOR staffers, Linda Scher recommends Waiting by Hodgin, which she says is about frustrated love, but it's excellent. And so part of what sets non-romance novels apart from romance novels is that the love... does not have to have a happy ending. So frustrated love in literature, I think we can all agree that's a pretty major theme.
Mrs. Dalloway.
It's romantic.
Thwarted love.
And we also hear from Danny Alexander that The Flame and the Flower and The Wolf and the Dove were her rewards in college after term papers were done and exams were turned in.
Yes, Kathleen Woodowis. We all read her.
Our time is up, but keep telling us your thoughts about romance novels in this day and age, and keep recommending great love stories from all of literature. We're at KCUR-CST. Jeffrey and Gowdy, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, music and drinks, not a bad combo, right? We will hear about the Kansas City Standard back in the jazz era and local distilleries and vineyards in our own time. So tune in tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.